Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome to XYZ, XYZ, whatever you want to call it. This is the podcast for people into CNCing, machining, 3D printing, whatever it may be, anything that has an XYZ access. With myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, and Aaron Goff of Goff Customs. How are you, Aaron?
Going good, mate. Very good. A bit sleep deprived. We just got a puppy.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Oh. So is that more noise we're going to hear? So we're going to hear the cat and the puppy now?
Hopefully not.
What kind of puppy is it?
I don't know. She's a mix of some kind. She's very cute. She's Brindle. I can tell you exactly how cute she is, actually. She ate my AKG headphones, and I'm not even mad at her.
Oh, wow. She must be cute. Okay. Yeah, that's cute. Fair enough. How old?
I don't know. About 8 months or so.
Oh, lovely.
And she's a tripod. She's missing one front leg.
Really? Yeah. Oh, did you get it from like a rescue place?
Yeah, she was found in a forest. She's been hit by a car or something. Her leg was broken three places. So she's only been a tripod for about 3 or 4 weeks. She just learned how to jump on the couch the other day. She's doing pretty good.
Is this some sort of experiment for you? So you can 3D print some sort of harness leg or something?
I actually want to do that, yeah. We didn't get it for that reason. We didn't take off our leg.
That's not the purpose.
Just so I can print a new one. No, I do have a buddy who's a prosthetics technician. So we're going to work something out, I hope.
Jeez, anything for these YouTube vids, eh?
Right.
Wow. Well, I've seen actually that I've spoken to a few friends who, with lockdown, everybody being at home, it's like the perfect time to get a puppy.
Right.
But apparently, it's just been quite difficult to get hold of dogs and puppies because there's such a demand.
Thinking the same way, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so what did you call the tripod?
Tilly. Tilly the tripod.
Tilly. Nice. Very
so
nice.
Cute. How are things with you, mate?
Good. I'm very good. I've had a really sort of positive week. I was quite down last week. So this week has been good. I've been doing a bit of exercise as well to get the sort of blood pumping in the mornings and getting up and sort of facing the world with a big hit.
Nice.
So it's been good. I've been working on like a one-off knife, which I very rarely do. I was sort of in this funk of doing, orders, constant orders of basically the same stuff for months and months and months. So I thought, let's just take a bit of time out and work on something, just be a bit more creative. So that's been really nice, and that's finished now. So I am back on the orders, but with a newfound vigour, let's say. Yeah, it's all good.
That's good.
Yourself?
I've been productive. I've been working on orders, the same as usual, but some new stuff thrown in there as well. I've been officially starting work on the Resolute Mark IV, the new Resolute.
Ow.
So, yeah, first step on that's been, redoing all my CAD drawings from 2015, which has been a bit nuts.
So is the difference, the major difference in the production as opposed to the actual style of the knife?
Yeah, I mean, if you looked at the two and you weren't, really good with your eyes, super attention to detail, then you probably wouldn't see much difference, but there will be quite a few under the hood changes.
Got you. Gotcha. I'm very intrigued about your bit of a teaser you put up on Instagram of possible having transparent sheaths.
Oh, yeah,
is that right?
You'll see.
Oh. So, not Kydex. I won't press you too much because I know they haven't been released or anything yet. So, an alternative to Kydex, I'm assuming, is it?
Secrets. Big secrets.
Okay, I won't press you at all. Okay. But it sounds very cool anyway.
Yeah, it was fun. So I polished up the thermoforming mold that I used to make my Kydex sheaths. And it was kind of fun, kind of relaxing. Just sat there, watched some TV, and wet sanded that thing up to 1,000 grit.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So when are we likely to see any results from this?
A couple of months.
Oh, come on.
Keep you waiting.
Come on. Big tease. Yeah. Okay, so I'm looking through the notes that we have here because, yes, listeners, we do try to have some sort of order here, believe it or not. And we've got a bunch of things, and it's mainly 3D printing, about 3D printing.
Yeah, I'm all 3D printing.
And there's a reason. There is a reason for that, because we were going to have a guest today, which is going to be in maybe in a week or two's time. We won't tell you who, but it's quite a big noise in the 3D printing world. So this is going to be probably quite 3D printing focused. And the first thing we've got on the list here is pellet extruding.
Yeah.
So obviously we're used to extruding, you know, these big sort of wires, these big reels of filament. But pellet extruder, I haven't seen one. Have you seen one in action?
Yes, I have actually. And it's worth noting that like pellets are the way that plastic comes. Like if you're injection molding or whatever, you're never going to get, you know, filament. You'll always get pellets. So the interesting thing about like, let's say you could magically have a 3D printer that perfectly extrudes pellets. All of a sudden your material is way cheaper, way cheaper. And there's like 1,000 different types of material. Like whatever you want, you can get it. Because you know, there's tons of stuff out there and you don't have to wait for it to be, you know, turned into a filament. And to give you an idea of how much cheaper it is, so there's a company called 3DX Tech that make really high-end 3D printing filaments. And their carbon fiber nylon filament is about $98 US for a kilo. Whereas you can buy pellets from them as well. So they sell pellets so you can compound your own filament and extrude your own filament. And the exact same carbon fiber nylon, a kilo of pellets is like $24.
Wow. So 25% of the price. Yeah. Wow. That's incredible.
And that's probably on the high end. Like if you just went on eBay or went to a plastic supplier, you know, you could probably buy it even cheaper.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking at the pellet extruders, and you've linked to one, which we'll put down in the show notes there. But you're talking about $500 for the actual extruder.
And that's cheap. There are other ones that are like $3,000, wow. $4,000, $5,000.
Wow. And are they just sort of gravity fed? Like you'd have a big hopper and you just pour in the pellets?
Yeah. That's the most obvious way of feeding them. You can feed them with vacuum systems and stuff to like transport the pellets from larger bins. But yeah, I think gravity feed makes the most sense. But there's a ton of advantages there. Like the material's way cheaper, so you can use a big nozzle and really big prints, and it won't cost you a whole lot. Especially if you were going to print like PLA. PLA is like $25 for 5 kilos or something, you know, like in pellet form, maybe even less. And then, you know, if you're running out of pellets, you just pour some more in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I'd imagine if you get, you know, some sort of valve system going, you could have some different colors and you can make some nice sort of, really mix them up in any sort of way you want it. That could be pretty cool.
Yeah. So, it's super, super interesting idea. The one disadvantage of it is that because it's not a filament, you don't really have any way of doing a retraction. So at the end of each segment, when you're 3D printing, you're like squirting out the hot plastic, and then you get to the end and normally the printer will execute a retraction, so it actually pulls the filament back, and that kind of suctions the molten plastic out of the nozzle area of the printer so that it doesn't leak any plastic as it moves to the next bit. So, without retraction, you get a fair bit more stringing and so on. And the other reason that, like, so lots of companies like Prusa and so on, they really accurately control the diameter of their filament, and the reason that they do that is because, you know, you're pushing a certain amount of filament in terms of length, And if the diameter varies a lot, then volumetrically, you're extruding different amounts of filament.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, I've just had some delivered this morning, some PETG from Prusa, and they all come with a little QR code, and because they make it all in-house, they've got their own extruding units there, and you can actually see all those details,
yeah.
So that, you know, the temperature is extruded at, the diameter, exact diameter, and even down to the color, they make sure that if you're using, you know, a certain color, that if you were to buy a batch in 3 months' time, they're going to make sure that it's exactly color matched.
Yeah,
it's incredible what they do there.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, for a pellet extruder, because you're basically using a screw to squish molten plastic through a nozzle, I don't think it has the same level of accuracy in terms of volumetric extrusion. So
right,
that means
yeah.
like the outside walls of your print will be a bit less even than they would be with filament, but you know, if you're printing like giant things, then maybe that's just not a big deal.
Hmm. Yeah.
But yes, it was super interesting.
And you know, that sort of $500 for the extruder, it's one of those things, isn't it? If they're making more of them, they'd be far cheaper.
Yeah.
And it only takes one, whether it's Prusa or MakerBot or something like that, to you know, make a sort of desktop version of that, for those prices to come way, way down as everybody basically rips them off and does their own cheaper versions.
Yeah, I think it's super cool. I was looking at it because I was like, whoa, what new materials can I get? So I've been printing some fun stuff. I've been printing carbon fiber nylon, which is actually, honestly, it's super easy. I've been really impressed at how easy it is to print. And then going to just plain nylon with no carbon fiber, and that stuff is the most horrible shit. I do not want to print it anymore. Like it's impossible to dry it almost. Like I've literally had a reel of that in my oven at 90 degrees Celsius for 24 hours now, and it still prints like it's wet.
Oh jeez.
And like the adhesion to the bed is not good, and yeah, it's terrible stuff. And it looks like shit too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's amazing to see these different things that we can print on. And I saw this week about people printing ceramics.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds impressive anyway.
Did you actually read the article? I read through the link.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I've got it open now. So not only are they printing ceramics, they're printed in space. In space. So I think they're using sort of SLA way of doing with a resin, and they're sort of resin printing the ceramic. But they're using it to make turbines, which we talked about last week. You know, perfect. 3D printing is perfect for things like that. Yeah. Incredible.
That's super cool.
Living in the future.
I think unfortunately that article is a little bit of a press release, because I was reading through some bits of it and they're like, what it says, like, now that we are printing pre-ceramic resin. I'm like,
pre-ceramic.
What's a pre-ceramic? And then they're like, this will drastically increase the production of ceramics in space. From zero to something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they say they're printing components on board the International Space Station now. But yeah, as to what a pre-ceramic is.
Right? Yeah. I love the idea. I just hate it when companies release, like, you know, I hate press releases, man. They're stupid.
Well, I'm just reading the article now, and it's just full of, Redwire technology. Redwire technology, yeah. They're just, promoting the hell out of themselves.
Synergy.
Really,
Corporate synergy.
Yeah. But again, we'll put all these links down in the show notes, so you're just going to have a look as readers. What the hell? You know what? My wife released a book this week, so we've been talking about readers a lot.
That's nice.
Listeners. It's different media. This is different media. So whilst we're talking about space... rockets, 3D printed rockets. I think you've seen something this week.
Well, not this week. It's been around for a while, but it's just fucking awesome. Like, it doesn't have to happen this week, you know? Yeah, so there's this company, I think they're just called Rocket Labs. They're originally from New Zealand, and they have this very cool rocket, called the Electron, which is, so normally they use all sorts of interesting turbines and stuff that burn fuel in order to power the turbo pumps, which feed more fuel into the rocket engines. And these guys were like, well, let's just use batteries. So they actually use like big ass lithium polymer batteries and electric motors to drive their pumps that pump fuel into the rockets itself, which means it's much simpler. And then the entire rocket engine is 3D printed. Yeah, wow. It's very, very cool stuff. There's a bunch of companies that are working on that now. Because it just, like, rocket engines are incredibly expensive to produce. It's like basically like super fancy plumbing that has to go to space, you know, and there'll be like thousands of pipes in a rocket engine. So if you can 3D print it all in one piece, then like, why wouldn't you do that? You know, yeah. And you can, so like lots of rocket engines, the nozzle of the engine, it has to be cooled, otherwise it will melt. So they use what's called regenerative cooling, where they actually pump the fuel through channels that are in the nozzle before the fuel goes to the fuel injectors. And that actually helps, like, heat the fuel up and make it easier to burn and atomize and so on as well. But, like, the way they used to make those regenerative cooling channels was they'd start with, like, 1,000 pipes, and then they would bend them all and then weld them together, and then, you know, like, it was just incredibly... incredibly labor intensive. And now you can 3D printer, you know, an engine that has the nozzle with the regenerative cooling channels right into the nozzle as part of the printing.
Wow.
Yeah, super cool.
We back before the whole sort of knife making thing, before I was doing this, back in Wales where I lived, my wife and I we run this like a co-working space where people, you know, for makers, people could make stuff. And on the weekend we had, it was called Founders Hub, but we did this thing called the the Founders Hub Space Agency. So the idea was people would bring their kids in, and we were going to, the whole thing was, it would run for 5 weeks. And we'd say, how are we going to get into space? How can we just get into space, take some photos and come back down? So we had kids from sort of 5 years up into sort of, you know, and their parents, so right up to whatever age. And so the first week, everybody's coming up with these different ideas. And, you know, we knew how we were going to do it anyway, because you can buy the packs, you know, the helium balloons and the boxes and all the rest. You can buy those things. And so the first week then, everybody's like, rockets. So we got those, you know, those little explosive rocket packs you can buy. And they go up like crazy. And we had people making little, like, Arduino... like ignition packs for them, so you could be a fair distance, right. And it would, you know, make a heat, which would then do the igniters, and we'd send them up. That was so much fun. But I was amazed by these little explosive rockets, how high they went. But the kids then soon realized, well, we're not going to get into space doing that, you know. So we ended up doing the whole helium balloon thing, and we bought the whole pack. So it was the helium balloon. It was the the formed plastic box to put all the gubbins in, the GPS trackers and all that kind of thing. And I'd say that was so cool. We ended up having a few photos, and, you know, we spent the day tracking these things to see when they'd land. We sent four up. Mm-hmm. And we had to have special licenses as well to do it, because obviously it goes up to a certain height and it could be in airspace and all the rest of it. But I just think, imagine now having been able to 3D print rockets. Like, if it's available to anybody, can you imagine? It's just like, you know, before drones were available to everybody, you'd think, well, there's no way everybody would be allowed to do that. You've got to be thinking, there's got to be some sort of legislation coming that would stop people just going up into space. Where do you go for a license to go into space? You know, it's crazy.
Talk to the FAA. It's not that hard.
Yeah. Well, you go just into space. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. Speaking of 3D printing ceramics, so there are a whole bunch of like ceramic resins out there for SLA printers. It's basically, as I understand it, like a bunch of really fine clay powder suspended in a binder, and then you print with it, and then you fire it. And there's a particular rocket engine design called Vortex Cooled Rocket engine, where you inject the oxygen around the periphery of the chamber in order to keep it cool. And there are people on YouTube that are 3D printing vortex cooled rocket engines. And then running one of the guys, like, I love people. Like, some people are just nut bars, you know, and I know I was like this when I was a kid. Like, my parents let me buy a bench grinder with my pocket money when I was like 13. And then they were like, oh yeah, just run an extension cord out to the, like, the picnic table down there and you know, go wild. I don't think I had safety glasses. Like, I know I injured myself and hid it from my parents, you know, like, but people yeah. like this, that, you know, this guy's, running a friggin' rocket engine on, he was running, I think it was like liquid oxygen and propane in his like bedroom. You know, no safety glasses in sight. I don't condone it, but you know, I do love that people are just, you know, doing shit.
Wow. Yeah, but
where's some safety glasses?
It gets more and more affordable and available to people, it's just going to be crazy. It's going to be a free-for-all up there.
I think it's still quite hard to get into space. Easy to make something go, you know, high up and whatever, but space, I think, is... If it was easy, everyone would be doing
it. I suppose, yeah.
Speaking of which, like, SpaceX are actually trying for their next launch today, I believe. Which will be yesterday in listener time. But yeah, Starship SN9 is supposed to be, serial number 9, supposed to be doing its test flight soon.
And what's the purpose of that? What are they testing for?
To not blow up.
The most obvious of all things.
Yeah, they're going to try the same thing as the last one, SN8, which is they're basically doing like a miniature flight test. So they'll take it up to a certain altitude and then do the belly flop maneuver and come back down and then try and do propulsive landing. So they light the rockets.
Which is super cool.
Yeah, and last time they had an issue with pressure in the header tanks feeding fuel, or not feeding fuel, as it were. And then they had a bit of a explodey moment. So this time I think they're going to try and have 100% less explosions.
Nice. So these are unmanned, I assume.
No, they put people in them. You just hope for the best.
Wow. Okay.
No, they're unmanned.
Wow. What do you? Who knows? Stronger. Who knows? I don't know.
Would you volunteer for that shit? The first.
I certainly. Yeah. Would. For, no,
well,
test
I mean,
flights.
We don't really know if it's going to work. We don't really care. But do you want to get in it? No. No, it's all sacrificial computers.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Fair
Maybe
enough.
Some
talking
specially
about
trained
sacrificial.
Hamsters. But no.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about sacrificial computers and, you know, sacrificial as in cheap, reusable, almost disposable. Raspberry Pi have released their microcontroller.
Yeah.
Which they're calling the Pi Pico.
Yeah, and it's only $4, which is crazy.
Yeah.
And you can program it in C or MicroPython, which is very cool. I mean, I have one friend in particular who will like that because he refuses to use anything other than Python. You know who you are.
Right.
Obstinate bastard. But yeah, it looks really cool. So like it's a custom silicone design from Raspberry Pi. And yeah, it seems like it would be a decent replacement for an Arduino in a lot of applications.
Yeah, and these were, well, the original Raspberry Pis were actually manufactured back in my hometown in Cardiff. Nice. This small dot of a place on the planet.
So they were very unreliable.
Is where they were making them. Probably. But I mean, $4 for a microcontroller.
Yeah, it's a bit nice.
For about $5 or $6, though, you can get the Pi Zero, which is basically a full-on computer.
Yeah,
you
know? The different applications, though, right? Like the Pi Zero runs an operating system, and so if you need, like, you know, your code to do something in real time, that's not a great choice. Whereas the Pico would be. So yeah, I'm really curious what integrations there are between like the standard Raspberry Pi and the Pico. Like is there some sort of ecosystem there where they integrate better than an Arduino would or something?
Maybe. I don't know. But I've got a bunch of Pis here, you know, for a bunch of different things. Mainly for emulating 80s video games, but you know. They do the job. I'm looking through the notes here, and the next thing, I don't believe you. I simply, factually, it cannot be correct. It's got nothing to do with CNCing. It's got nothing to do with machining or computers or space even. But I just don't believe it.
Yeah, apparently octopuses only have 6 legs. They have 2 arms and 6 legs. But, yeah, it blows my mind. I don't know. The coolest thing, though...
2 arms, 4 legs.
Yeah, so the coolest thing, though, is how they found that out. Like, I was like, how do you find out whether an octopus has 2 arms?
So they should be hectopuses,
yeah,
I suppose.
Right. Yeah, so what they did is they put an octopus in a tank, like a little, you know, aquarium tank, and then they pointed a gun at it, and they said, put your hands up.
Stick your hands up.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, I couldn't resist.
Of course.
No, apparently they only have 6 legs. Yeah, it's not at all CNC related. Guys, I swear to God, we'll talk about CNC in a minute, but like, you know, what the hell?
Hectopuses. Who would have thought? Yeah.
All right, let's talk about CNC stuff for a minute.
Okay,
I guess
I know you've been working on some of your old. You talked about earlier some of your older sort of CAD drawings.
Yeah, and it's really interesting going back. So, like my original CAD drawings for the Resolute for the hunting knife, camping knife that I make. I did those drawings in 2015 when I was just learning CAD, which is such a bad idea. Like it's, you know, the most important drawing, and you learn it while doing it, but you know. That's
the best way to learn on a practical project. Yeah. I think it's the best way.
But yeah, I went back and started refactoring those drawings because they were very unwieldy. You know, nothing was named properly and everything was in weird orders. And, you know, so if you wanted to change something, it was a lot of hunting around. And so in Fusion, you have the timeline of your drawing. You have all the operations that you've done in that drawing at the bottom. And when I started the timeline was 3.5 screens wide. Like it was just massive. And now it's less than 1. At one point I refactored 12 separate operations into just 2, you know, so, yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised though, how easy that process was. So like the first pass through that only took about 3 hours, which is, I was expecting to spend days on it, you know? But yeah, so now I'm doing some of the harder stuff. Like I will say if you're going to use Fusion, which you should, and if you're going to use components, which you should. So if you're, let's say you're making like a little boxcar racer or something, you'd have one component for the body and then one component for the wheel. And then you would make like multiple instances of that wheel component. Just do yourself a favor and make the components before you start making any sketches or anything like that. I did it ass backwards back in the day where, you know, I would make a sketch, I would extrude that into a solid so you have a body, and then I'd make a component from that body. And the problem is that means that your sketches and your original extrusion belong to the, like, parent component, not to the wheel component.
Okay, yeah,
that right. Makes sense. So you end up with this, like, stupid structure where sketches aren't where you expect that they should be, and it turns out that undoing that is really difficult. So like that's the thing that I'm trying to fix now, and basically what I'm literally having to do is like go back and create components earlier in the timeline and then redo all of the operations after that in the correct place, because you can't actually like move them around easily. So
got you. Well, I've actually been doing a course on Fusion this week. I started. So I don't know if you know Bob from I Like to Make Stuff. It's a YouTube channel. And basically he makes all sorts of stuff, from electronics projects to like beds, you know, basically anything. Cool. But he's a bit of a whiz with Fusion 360. So he's made this online course. And it was cheap. I think it was like $80 or something like that. And it'll teach you, you know, from if you've never used it to, you know, being quite proficient. So I think it's probably about a 40-hour course. I've done about 90 minutes so far. It's just finding that time.
Right.
But what I'm really interested in, something he's talking about, is when you're making your components, using, I can't think of the phrase that, well, or the terminology of it that he was using. But basically, putting all your dimensions in. So when you look at the whole project, let's say you needed to resize something, everything would resize.
Yeah.
You know, proportionally. And I can't remember what.
Generally, that's referred to as like being parametric modeling.
That's it. Yes. Which I think is quite exclusive, isn't it?
SolidWorks does that too, and I'm sure that other Bobcat or whatever do. There's history-based modeling, which is like SketchUp. You know, so you create a box and you add a cylinder on top of it, and you know, you size those things at when you make them, but then afterwards they're not like inherently linked to that size.
And that's my sort of always been my approach using things like Tinkercad and things like that. It's you know, very basic.
Yeah, and you are not going to believe that you spent so long doing shit that way. Honestly, I'm sure that you've had points where you're like, you know, you have to change some little dimension in a drawing, and then that means that you have to like recreate all of those bodies, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that was what I was used to, because I learned SketchUp before I really learned anything else. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is it. It's not too bad. But then you get into like a bigger drawing and you're like, oh my God, you know, kill me, please. Like, this is horrible. Whereas in like SolidWorks or Fusion, you would like, you make a 2D sketch and you would dimension that sketch. So you'd say, you know, oh, I'm making a box 2 inches by 3 inches. And then you extrude it 1 inch, whatever. And then you place a cylinder on one face of that in the center. And those are all linked by constraints. So your cylinder is linked to the center point of that face. And if you go back in time, like you scrub back through the timeline or you double click on a dimension and change it, so now it's like 2 inches by 2 inches, the box will resize and then the cylinder will move so that it's still in the center of that face.
Gotcha.
So I was actually helping a friend the other day who is also learning Fusion, and he designs furniture, and he was struggling a little bit with how to like structure things. And I walked him through and I said, okay, so now you want your table to be, you know, 3 feet long rather than 6. So just change that one dimension. And he did. And then, you know, you hit enter and it says like calculating, and then the whole drawing changes and your legs are in the right place. Yeah. And your, you know, all your curves are still there, all your chamfers and radiuses and stuff. But like, now the table's a different size. And he was like, holy shit. Because he's been doing all of this furniture design in SketchUp. And that means that like every time a customer comes in, they're like, oh, I want that table, but it has to be like 6 inches longer. He either has to manually fudge the drawings for his guys, or he has to like basically redraw that thing, you know?
Gotcha. Yeah. I think my thing, my sort of downfall has been with any sort of new software or anything that I'm trying to learn is dive straight in, and when I get stuck, go and find something to help fix this specific problem.
Yeah, I do that a bit too.
Then move on. But I mean, what that doesn't teach me is the fundamentals, you know. So I'm hoping this course will, you know, slow me down and say, look, start in the right way. And like you said, structure is quite a big thing within Fusion, making sure you're getting that structure correct. So yeah, so hopefully that's going to be a big sort of bonus for me at least.
Yeah, because like, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter what order you can create the components in, but like knowing that you should create components and that, you know, so you can change between which component is active, like which component you're working inside. And it's pretty easy to like forget that you're on the wheel component, but you're doing work on the body of the car. And then all of the history for that work is in the wheel rather than the car body, you know. And then long term, having stuff messed up like that makes it really painful.
Which is almost what you're working through now.
Yeah, so like my original drawing, so you can imagine a knife and it has the blade and then it has the handle scales. There were three components in this drawing, but the handle scale component was inside the blade component, and then the second handle scale component was inside the first handle scale component. So what that meant was, like, when I drop that CAD drawing into another design, so like a fixture or something, right, and I want to turn off the handle scale, like I can turn off the right handle scale without turning off the left, but I can't turn off the left handle scale without also turning off the right.
Got you, yes, yeah.
You know, and I can't turn off the blade without also turning off the handle scales. Like, in terms of, because, you know, a lot of times you'll want to just machine the blade. So you want to, like, turn off the visibility of the handle scales so that you can machine them. You know, you can position the blade and then machine it in this one operation.
Yes,
and because I screwed up the structure, it just meant that, like, it was constantly a hassle to deal with. So I probably should have fixed it a long time ago. Yeah, and then the other one is, like, as I said previously, I said this in a previous episode, but I previously went crazy with having every component in a separate file. And then that means that, like, every time you update one file, you have to manually go in and, like, say, yes, I want to pull in that update in the other files. And then, so I had, you know, my knife model, and then I had individual components of my fixtures, so, like, the different fixture stations. And then I had one drawing that brought in the individual fixture stations and assembled them, and then brought in the knife model. So, but it meant that I had, like, whenever I updated the knife, I had to bring in the knife models in that, and then I had to update each of the individual fixture stations and then bring those in. And each time you do that, each time you actually change the physical model, you have to go through and regenerate all of the tool paths and everything. And if you're, like, changing stuff around too drastically, or if, you know, things aren't linked nicely, then the tool paths might lose their association to, like, a particular face or an edge or something. So, it was just a fucking nightmare. It's one of those things where it's, you have to learn, right? And that's fine. And in a job shop, this wouldn't have been a problem, right? Because you'd do a CAD model for someone and you'd use it for, you know, a week while you're doing production, and then you would, like, get rid of it and you would do the next thing. But because I've been working on the same stuff for years,
every iteration, you need to go back in.
And that CAD drawing that has all my fixtures and everything, that has like 560 iterations, like 560 saved versions, right? So
is it like final one, final two, this is really the final three, this really is the final four? Is that your name and structure?
I gave up on that a long time ago. It's a living document, you know. Every day I think about something, I could change that, you know, make a change. But it was really nice doing the refactoring, because then I was like, you know, what happens if I change the blade bevel like this? And it was, all of a sudden, it was like a 2-minute change, you know, and the recalculation of everything was like super quick. So it definitely pays to, like, learn how things are supposed to be structured.
Now, what I'm finding with a lot of sort of tutorials, you know, a lot of sort of YouTube videos, that kind of thing as well, regarding Fusion, is they're based on almost like furniture.
Yeah, right.
You know, that kind of thing. Whether you're not really for machining, it's literally just so you can get your plans together. So I was thinking, what would be a good model for newcomers like me who will eventually be machining these things? And I think a knife probably is a good one, isn't it? Because, you know, there's not too many, unless it's like a folding knife, which, I mean, that's the goal, to be able to model a folding knife and then be able to use the animate feature and being able to, you know, to do all that kind of stuff. But yeah, if you're just doing sort of a fixed blade, it probably is a really good model to start with, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Like, someone that's new at CAD will have trouble making the blade bevel oftentimes. I mean, I can explain how to do it. It just may not be the best in a podcast format. But yeah, basically what you want to do is, like, make your blade profile, you know, just the 2D kind of blank. Extrude that so that you've got, you know, a thick blank, like you would, you know, cutting a knife out of a piece of steel, but you haven't sharpened it or anything yet. And then where the plunge line is going to go, you actually create a sketch going through the blade, like from edge to spine. And then make a triangle in there that is like the negative of your blade bevel, like the area that you're going to cut away. And then sweep that sketch along the edge of the blade. So it cuts away the material to make your bevel. And then you mirror that. So one thing you should always try and think about is, like, rather than drawing something twice, look for ways that you could do it using a pattern or a mirror. The really nice thing about that is if you go back and you change the drawing on the first side, it automatically happens on the second side. So it feels very natural. But that's it. Like, once you realize how to do it, it's very, very straightforward. But Yeah, like someone that's newer at CAD trying to make a blade bevel in Fusion is often a bit of a sticking point.
Which brings me on to something which it's been bugging me for a while now. So as you know, I've been looking for a machine, an affordable machine, and you know, I've now committed to the Onefinity, which I'm really glad actually one of our listeners has replied to us saying that they've recently had one, and they're really, really happy with how sturdy it is and all that. Sort of that buyer's regret that I originally had, I think I don't have with this machine, thankfully. But what I'm seeing, particularly with routers, so CNC routers as opposed to mills, are some are saying like 2.5D, and some are saying like true 3D. And I can't get my head around the difference between these. What I imagine this meaning is 2.5D will do 3D, but in a very sort of linear way, almost like a 3D printer would. Whereas 3D will sort of contour on demand, if that makes
sense.
Yeah,
you're not wrong. I mean, basically what it's saying is like a 2.5D machine can really only move two axes at a time. Right? So it can move the X and Y and you know, cut out a pocket with a flat bottom. And it can do that at different heights, but it can't move all three axes at the same time to, you know, make like a 3D carved face or something.
Gotcha.
And yeah, stay the fuck away from 2.5D machines. Because you're going to really quickly outgrow a 2.5D machine. And
yeah.
And the problem is that a lot of the tool paths that are like really nice for a machine like that need 3D machining. So if you were, let's say you're doing something really simple, like machining a square pocket with a flat bottom, you have to like get the end mill down into that pocket. And the nicest way to do that is with a helix, right? To do a helical bore, you know, to a particular depth and then start cutting outward toward the edges of the pocket. But a helix is a 3D move. So you can't do that on a 2.5D machine.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think my head was virtually there, but you just explained it a lot better than I possibly could.
Yeah, and I have a friend who had a 2.5D machine, and he grew frustrated with that thing very quickly. So, like, yeah, you can do a ton with them, right? Like, if it's that or nothing, then yeah, sure, like a 2.5D machine will work. And I even know machinists who have 2D machines. So, like a Bridgeport milling machine that's been converted to CNC, but the Z-axis hasn't been converted. So you have to like manually set the Z height, you know, and like they do great work with them, but I would never willingly choose that over a 3D machine, you know? So yeah, I mean, you do what you must, but like, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah. I mean, my goal with this machine, as I've spoken about before, is for handles. So my handles aren't really shaped that much. There's obviously a radius around all the edges. But the only other sort of shaping on it, I suppose, is that bit where the junctions towards the blade, where it sort of sweeps back at 45 degrees there. So I'm pretty sure that this machine will be fine for that. But yeah, I suppose if I want to do more sort of sculpting.
So the Onefinity machine is only 2.5D?
I'm not sure. I'm going to check now. Let me check.
I can't imagine it would be.
Onefinity CNC.
Yeah, we can all listen to Craig type in this.
This is good radio, This is good radio. did it. Specifications. Let's have a look.
You're about to get buyer's remorse in 3, 2.
Live on air. I can't see, actually. It doesn't really list in the specifications.
Yeah, well, hopefully not. I mean, one of the things is, too, that, like, that's just a software controller thing, right? So if it was, like, limited to 2.5D because it was running Garble, whatever it's called, which I don't think Garble is actually limited to 2.5D. I don't think that's a thing. But...
Oh, here we go. 3D visualization of G-code paths. So I'm going to assume
That means that the controller will like show you the G code before it cuts it.
Ah, okay. Ah, right. Just visualization. Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Fingers crossed, Craig.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. Yeah, it doesn't actually
I don't think we want to listen to you read the spec sheet anymore, you bastard.
So what have you got planned for the week? Anything special?
I'm going to be cranking the next couple of days, actually. I have been very productive this month so far, and I sent a batch of Blades to DLC last week, and they are just about to come back. Fingers crossed that it will be not shit. Yeah, so those are... I'm trying to get those ready for like the end of the month so that I can list knives that are like basically done.
The DLC coating that you have, can that be any color?
No. No, it cannot.
Right, okay. It's always... It's
yeah,
always
so
black.
For those listening, I mean, so DLC stands for diamond-like carbon. So they're basically, it's a vacuum, like a vapor deposition coating, PVD coating. And they're literally like... It's super cool, actually. They use an ion beam to chip off individual atoms of carbon off a sputtering target. And then those charged carbon atoms are attracted to the blades and self-assemble into like a layer on the blades. So it really only comes in two options. Well, there's a couple. There's like black, there's a gray, and then there's like a rainbow. So the rainbow looks like an oil slick. It's very, basically they achieve that look by making the coating quite thin, and then you get like weird optical interference that makes it look like an oil slick. It can look cool, but I'm not a big fan of that personally. So yeah, I just try to go with the black.
With the standard black, yeah. Yeah.
But there are other coatings that are different colors, right? So like DLC is one of, you know, many coatings that my coating supplier does. So like you can get titanium nitride, which is gold. Like those you would have seen like gold drill bits. Yeah, those are titanium nitride. Yeah. Then you can get titanium carbon nitride, which is a black version of that coating. Aluminum titanium nitride is kind of a purple. And then you can change the colors a bit too by texturing. So like titanium nitride on a matte substrate looks like bronze.
Right,
The biggest issue is that many of the coatings can't be... Like they have to apply them at certain temperatures. So like... And it will depend on the supplier too. So like my coating supplier can only do titanium nitride 600 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. Which is higher than the tempering temperature that I use for my blades. So I can't do that. But yeah, DLC can be applied, you know, just under 400. So that's fine for me.
Nice. The only reason I was thinking that is I've seen a bunch of knives this week, you know, people have been made, and they've been these various colours, and I was thinking it's a ceramic coating or whatever it may be, but just from your videos in the past, I know, you know, the ceramic isn't as hardy as the DLC stuff anyway, so it probably wouldn't
Be like good. Cerakote, the, you know, when people say ceramic coatings, they're normally referring to something like Cerakote, which is a fancy like two-part epoxy baked on paint that has like ceramic in it as a wear resistance media. And I mean, that stuff's pretty hardy, but if you use your knife like regularly, then it's going to wear and it's going to like wear noticeably. Yeah. Whereas the PVD coatings like DLC, they're much, much harder. Like they're actually harder than the steel of the blade itself. So
can it be lasered DLC?
Yeah, I would imagine so. Cause it's just carbon. If you heat it up high enough, it'll oxidize. So yeah, you should be able to like laser through it, make patterns.
Nice.
Am I giving you ideas now?
No. I've got nobody around here to do DLC. I've already checked to see if anybody around here could do DLC. I've got this idea of. So I'm currently sort of prototyping a folding knife, and it's quite cool actually. I've been using the 3D printer to sort of, you know, prototype the parts and things like that, so I can have it in my pocket and see how it feels with the rough edges and all that kind of thing. But I was thinking like all. At the moment, you see it everywhere, just everything all black, matte black, everything. And I was thinking that would be really cool to have everything black. Also find it difficult to find we're going into knife making now as opposed to CNC. But like Corby bolts, anything other than brass is just basically a coating on top of the brass. So by the time you grind them down, it's still brass showing through and stuff. But yeah, black. I'm desperate to get something black. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, and like, you know, so I have some friends that make like really high-end folding knives and DLC coating of individual fasteners, like little screws and stuff, is finicky. You can do it. There are companies that do it.
I can imagine, yeah.
But yeah, it's finicky for sure. It sounds like fun.
Cool. So you've got these knives coming back from DLC.
That's good news. Working on assembly and so on. So yeah, I'm just going to be crushing that the next couple of days because I'm not really behind schedule, but I'm a little bit behind where I'd like to be. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm in the situation where I don't really want to be producing too much at the moment, just because I'm so uncertain of the shipping.
With Brexit?
It's just, yeah. Well, with Brexit and just generally, like customs, right. Everywhere seems to be delayed. Everything held up in customs, and the more I send, the more problems I'm getting.
Because you're just using the regular postal service, right?
I've got very little choice here, to be
honest. Yeah, I found over the last year that the postal service like was previously pretty reliable for me, and then all of a sudden it was like from Canada to the States, you know, the customs and stuff would be like 3 weeks, which it's nuts. So yeah, I switched to DHL, and now shipments to the States are like next day, second day, like.
So we've got that issue with customs, but also with a lot of my customers are UK based, and with Brexit there, and also buying stuff from a lot of my suppliers were UK based, which I'm having to sort of look elsewhere now because there's like a 30% charge on top now. You know, all of a sudden the stuff I buy is 30% more, and the shippers are actually looking for more money as well. So it's just an absolute
nightmare. Brexit will be good for UK businesses.
Which idiot thought that? So I mean, production wise, it's I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. Right. So what has been nice is I've had quite a large order from a restaurant that I worked with a few years ago. They've ordered again, which is nice to hear because, you know, restaurants are, you know, they've been struggling. Mm-hmm. So this particular one is in Singapore, so I think they haven't been hit too hard. And it is good to hear that they're thriving. So that's good news, and hopefully for other restaurants, you know, to come. But I mean, what have I got this week? So, I want to do more YouTube stuff. So not because I think I've got lots of good stuff to share, but I just really enjoy the process of just creating stuff. And yesterday, I spent 4 hours yesterday with a fish tank to make a little promo video for this one-off knife that I've done, and watching lots of videos, you know, how to shoot underwater and get really great lighting and all that kind of thing. I ended up with a 15-second clip that I could use after 4 hours. Yeah. But the whole point is I want to be, with regards to YouTube and all the rest of it, I want to be doing like everything. I want to be doing the making the music, any music that I use, I want to make myself. So that's what I'm gonna be doing this week. So it actually came just the other day, one of these little MIDI keyboards, one of these Akai MPK MIDI.
Of course, things. You need more toys. To make it, more excuses to get toys.
But, you know, it's for, you know, beeps and thumps and all that kind of, you know, the kind of stuff that makes, you know, YouTube videos good. You can time everything.
I'm looking forward to listening to your music now. It's going to be full of beeps and thumps.
But, I mean, like you, I'm a guitarist. I play guitar. But, you know, that takes a lot of time to write stuff. Whereas, you know, I can just press a button on a MIDI keyboard instead. So. So I'm hoping to get some YouTube because I'd be moving to this new shop now within a few weeks. I'll start that whole making of the new shop. So I think that could be quite nice to sort of document on YouTube and all that kind of stuff. So using this this time where I don't want to be shipping so much, and I mean I don't sell anything locally here. Everything I sell either goes to the States, the UK, or the sort of Arab Emirates, really. You know, that's where all my knives go. So whilst I'm, you know, awaiting shipping to sort itself out, which hopefully this is a blip, Speaking to other makers, they're finding, you know, similar issues as well, stuff being held up in customs and so on. So, you know, hopefully this is a blip and maybe it's COVID related. I don't know. But using this time to learn something new with the Fusion course, mm-hmm. and making some music and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so that's my nice. Week. Hmm. So we're hoping next week to have a guest, which we should have had this week.
We haven't had good luck with guests. Maybe we should just give up.
We have. Our listeners must think we're crazy because we've yet to have a guest on the show. But we've recorded with one, and one we had a cancellation literally an hour or so before recording today. We're hoping to reschedule that one. If you've got any questions, maybe 3D printing related, without giving it away who this may be, send them over to us. We are xyz.cnc on Instagram, and we can make sure that we bring these up with our very special guest.
I've got a big list of questions. I've got a huge list of questions.
I've seen the notes already. I have. I think that's a show. I think we've covered everything that we needed to. We shall speak to you all again next week. And remember, give us some sort of like feedback or rating up or vote or whatever it is on whatever podcast platform you're listening to, because it really helps us to get sort of noticed by more people. The bigger audience we have, the more fun stuff we can do with the show, basically.
Yep. Yeah. And I know Jeff Fader will have loved my octopus dad joke earlier on. So, yeah. He can leave us another review.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much for listening. We shall speak to you again next week.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.